All right. I hope you all are excited about the course. It's very different, I think, than other classes, and there's great opportunity here to learn something new. Where I'd like to begin is at the beginning, and many people consider a speech by Richard Feynman in 1959 to be the beginning of nanoscale science. That's debatable, of course. Science, of course, always builds on itself, and you could maybe point back to Einstein and the photoelectric effect, or Planck and black body radiation as the true beginnings of nano. Maybe you go back further to Faraday. Faraday used gold nanoparticles in his research. Maybe you go back to the ancient Romans, who used gold nanoparticles in stained glass. At the time, I doubt they knew they were doing that. But the fact of the matter is, it's hard to say when things begin. But this is widely regarded in the field to be the beginning, is Richard Feynman's speech entitled "There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom." And what I'd like to do in this class is really take you to the primary source information. I'll give you some commentary on the primary source information, but I'm trying not to skew your opinion. I want you to develop your own opinions. And it's better to hear it from the horse's mouth than someone's interpretation of the horse's mouth. Before we do that, we need to talk about who Feynman was. And I've got a couple of links here. You can read his biography, which is from the Nobel Prize website, Feynman being a Nobel laureate in physics. But I find his obituary to be more interesting, and I would just like to read it, because it really covers his whole life and who Richard Feynman was as a man, in addition to who he was as a scientist. This was in 1988, February 17th, his obituary in the Boston Globe. I'm just going to read it to you. Richard P. Feynman, a Nobel laureate in physics, best-selling author and former member of the Presidential Commission that investigated the Challenger disaster, died Monday night in Los Angeles. He was 69. Mr. Feynman, who died at the University of California at Los Angeles Medical Center after an eight-year battle with abdominal cancer, was a popular and energetic lecturer who, despite his illness, continued to teach at Caltech until 2 weeks before his death. Mr. Feynman graduated from MIT in 1939 and received his PhD from Princeton in 42. He was a member of the team that developed the first atomic bomb at Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory. That is, he was a member of the Manhattan Project. He was widely known for his insatiable curiosity, gentle wit, brilliant mind, and playful temperament. His qualities were clearly evident in his popular 1985 book of reminiscences, "Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman," which was on the New York Times bestseller for 14 weeks. MIT physicist Philip Morrison called Mr. Feynman the most original theoretical physicist of our time. Morrison said Mr. Feynman, who called his Nobel Prize a pain in the neck, was extraordinarily honest with himself and everyone else, and added that he didn't like ceremony or pomposity. He was extremely informal. He liked colorful language and jokes. Mr. Feynman attracted widespread attention during the Rogers Commission hearings on the Challenger space shuttle accident in 1986. Frustrated by witnesses' vague answers and by slow bureaucratic procedures, he conducted an impromptu experiment that proved a key point in the investigation. He dunked a piece of the rocket booster's O-ring material into a cup of ice water and quickly showed that it lost all resiliency at low temperatures, something which all material scientists already know. In the commission's final report, Mr. Feynman accused NASA of playing Russian roulette with astronauts' lives. His driving curiosity was apparent when, in his last media interview, he told the Boston Globe last year that his work on the Shuttle Commission had so aroused his interest in the complexities of managing a large organization like NASA that if he were starting his life over, he might be tempted to study management rather than physics. Ever playful and unintimidated by authority, Mr. Feynman caused consternation in his years with the Manhattan Project, which developed the atomic bomb, by figuring out in his spare time how to pick the locks on filing cabinets that contained classified information. Without removing anything, he left taunting notes to let officials know that their security system had been breached. I think he'd be a computer hacker nowadays. Former Caltech president Marvin Goldberger, now director of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, said Mr. Feynman was a towering figure in 20th century physics, always curious, modest, ebullient, willing to share his deep insights with students and colleagues. He's awarded the Nobel Prize in 1965, along with Tobinaga and Schwinger. The three had worked independently on problems in the theory of quantum electrodynamics, which describes how atoms produce radiation. He reconstructed almost the whole of quantum mechanics and electrodynamics in his own way, deriving a way to analyze atomic interactions through simple diagrams, a method that is still used widely. He described the theory for a general audience in his 1986 book, QED, The Strange Theory of Light and Matter. An earlier textbook, The Feynman Lectures on Physics, was published in 1963 and remains a leading text in physics classes. In fact, if you have any interest in physics, I highly recommend his lectures on physics. In lectures, Mr. Feynman responded to charges that scientific understanding detracts from the aesthetic appreciation of nature. Quote, "The vastness of the heavens stretches my imagination. Stuck on this carousel, my little eye can catch 1 million-year-old light, a vast pattern of which I was a part. Perhaps my stuff was belched from some forgotten star, as one is belching there. It does not do harm to the mystery to know a little about it. Far more marvelous is the truth than any artist of the past imagined." Mr. Feynman leaves his wife, Gwyneth, a son Carl, a daughter Michelle, and sister Joan Feynman. Okay. So I find that very interesting to see who he was, and really the great diversity of things he did in his career. I was particularly impressed that he re-derived quantum mechanics his own way. I think my hope is that you all will have similar insight in this class. I'm going to present something to you, but I am always have great value for an independent, creative solution to a problem. Okay. So with that said, in the last 6 minutes or so, I'd like to introduce you to this speech. The speech will be online. You can read the whole thing if you like. It's pretty long. I just want to take you through it briefly, read the first few paragraphs, and then tell you what the rest of it is about. This was in 1959. Okay. "I imagine experimental physicists must often look with envy at men like Kamerlingh Onnes, who discovered a field like low temperature, which seems to be bottomless and in which one can go down and down. Such a man is then a leader and has some temporary monopoly in a scientific adventure. Percy Bridgman, in designing a way to obtain higher pressures, opened another new field, was able to move into it and to lead us all along. Development of ever higher vacuum was continuing development of the same kind. I would like to describe a field in which little has been done, but in which an enormous amount can be done in principle. This field is not quite the same as the others in that it will not tell us much of fundamental physics in the sense of what are the strange particles, but is more like solid-state physics in the sense that it might tell us of much of great interest about the strange phenomena that occur in complex situations. Furthermore, a point that is most important is that it would have an enormous number of technical applications. What I want to talk about is the problem of manipulating and controlling things on a small scale. As soon as I mention this, people tell me about miniaturization and how far it has progressed today. They tell me about electric motors that are the size of the nail on your small finger, and there's a device on the market, they tell me, by which you can write the Lord's Prayer on the head of a pin. But that's nothing. That's the most primitive, halting step in the direction I intend to discuss. It is a staggeringly small world that is below. In the year 2000, when they look back at this age, they'll wonder why it was not until the year 1960 that anyone began seriously to move in this direction." This is, of course, quite prophetic. The year 2000 was the year President Clinton announced the National Nanotechnology Initiative. "Why cannot we write the entire 24 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica on the head of a pin? Let's see what would be involved. The head of a pin is a 16th of an inch across. If you magnify it by 25,000 diameters, the area of the head of the pin is then equal to the area of all the pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Therefore, all it is necessary to do is to reduce in size all the writing in the encyclopedia by 25,000 times. Is that possible? The resolving power of the eye is about 1/120th of an inch. That is roughly the diameter of one little dots on the fine halftone reproductions in the encyclopedia. This, when you demagnify it by 25,000 times, is still 80 angstroms in diameter, 32 atoms across in an ordinary metal. In other words, one of those dots still would contain in its area 1,000 atoms. So each dot can easily be adjusted in size as required by the photo engraving. There's no question that there's enough room on the head of a pin to put all the Encyclopedia Britannica. Furthermore, it can be read if it is so written. Let's imagine that it is written in raised letters of metal, that is where the black is in the encyclopedia. We have raised letters of metal that are actually 1/25,000th of their ordinary size. How would we read it? If we had something written in such a way, we could read it using techniques in common use today. They will undoubtedly find a better way when we actually do have it written. But to make my point conservatively, I shall just take techniques we know today. We would press the metal into a plastic material and make a mold of it, then peel the plastic off very carefully, evaporate silica into the plastic to get a very thin film, and shadow it by evaporating gold at an angle against the silica so that all the little letters will appear clearly, dissolve the plastic away from the silica film, and then look through it with an electron microscope. What we cover in the next lecture is basically what he talks about there. There's no question that if a thing were reduced by 25,000 times in the form of raised letters on the pin, it would be easy for us to read it today. Furthermore, there's no question that we would find it easy to make copies of the master. We would just need to press the same metal plate again into the plastic and we would have another copy. And so Feynman can see that there's no real physical limitation to making things small. It's really just a matter of being particularly clever and designing instrumentation which allow us to do it. And that's where we're going to begin the course and how we process materials at the nanometer scale. How we can actually do the things that Feynman says and go much beyond what Feynman proclaims. Now, he speaks of a dot being 1,000 atoms or consisting of 1,000 atoms, and we'll see that today we can pattern at the single atom level routinely. Of course, we can't do it in an industrially viable way yet, but we can do it. So there's no doubt that he was right. There was plenty of room at the bottom. And I think with that, I'll conclude. I recommend that you read this if you want to see more of what he prophecies about. And I'll give you some couple more words about it next time before we move into the first lecture of the course. All right, thanks. Okay. Last time where we left off is we had just started talking about Feynman's speech. There's plenty of room at the bottom. And I mentioned you may want to read this on your own. I read through the first few paragraphs in class, and what we recognized is that Feynman was quite prophetic in predicting the consequences of nanotechnology, the great possibilities of making things smaller. He even specifically states the year 2000 as a point at which this would come to fruition. And as I mentioned, that was the year that President Clinton announced his National Nanotechnology Initiative. So it seems like Feynman is very prophetic. And as a result, when, in particular, the general public reads this speech, they tend to accept everything he says as the truth. And this, of course, is problematic. I don't know if any of you actually read the entire speech, but I recommend you do just to see where a lot of the misconceptions have come from. But his speech has, in many ways, been inspirational and helpful in the pursuit of this field, but in other ways, I would say, misleading and created unwarranted expectations for the field. And so it's important to read this to see where people get their notions from. And in particular, one of the things that Feynman talks about in detail is the idea of a molecular scale assembler, the idea that you can make using a conventional lathe, for example, you can machine a part small. And we'll say with a conventional lathe, we can get tolerance on the order of a thousandth of an inch. His idea is that you could then use the lathe to build another lathe at that length scale and use that smaller lathe to then machine down to another, say, 3 orders of magnitude smaller length scale and continue this all the way down to the molecular scale. And in that way, you could build up arbitrary structures in principle of one molecule or one atom at a time. And this is really caught in hold among, I'll say, the popular science community, the idea of a molecular scale assembler. This idea, which is very controversial and has led to some pretty dramatic debates in the literature, I included one of them on this list, a very famous debate ongoing between Rick Smalley and Eric Drexler, the two guys are shown here. Eric Drexler is a guy who wrote a book in the 1980s talking about the prospects and the possible problems of nanoscale science and technology, really pushing this idea of a molecular scale assembler. It should be pointed out that Drexler, for the past 15 or so years, has not published a paper in a peer-reviewed literature on his findings. So he's going unchecked. On the other hand, the other member of the debate is Rick Smalley. Rick Smalley, as you may or may not know, is a Nobel laureate in chemistry for the discovery of fullerenes, carbon nanotubes being a close descendant of that class of materials. And he very adamantly argues against the notion of molecular scale assembler. And in particular, what he's most concerned about is the stickiness of materials at very short length scales. And that's an issue which we'll talk about later on in the course. If you're interested in this debate, it's pretty famous, well documented. You may want to read this article, which I've put on the website. The other thing which Feynman does at the end of his speech, which is kind of interesting, I just want to say a couple of words about, is this last heading called High School Competition. And this is probably worth reading. Just for the fun of it, and in order to get kids interested in this field, I would propose that someone who has some contact with the high schools thinks of making some kind of high school competition. After all, we haven't even started in this field, and even the kids can write smaller than has ever been written before. They could have this competition in high schools. The Los Angeles High School could send a pin to the Venice High School, on which it says, "How's this?" You get the pin back, and in the dot of the I, it says, "Not so hot." Perhaps this doesn't excite you to do it, and only economics will do so. Then I want to do something, but I can't do it at the present moment because I haven't prepared the ground. It is my intention to offer a prize of $1,000 to the first guy who can take the information on the page of a book and put it on an area 125,000 smaller in linear scale in such a manner that it can be read by an electron microscope. And I want to offer another prize if I can figure out how to phrase it so I don't get into a mess of arguments about definitions, of another $1,000 to the first guy who makes an operating electric motor, a rotating electric motor which can be controlled from the outside and, not counting the lead-in wires, is only 1/64 of an inch cube. I do not expect that such prizes will have to wait very long for claimants. This notion of using competitions to drive technology is not a new one, very commonly used in aviation. In the early days, there were many prizes offered to drive aviators to push the boundaries of aviation. The most recent prize, what some of you may have heard about in the last year, is the so-called X Prize. The X Prize was recently claimed, and the X Prize, what it was supporting was a private manned spacecraft to exceed an altitude of 100 kilometers twice in as many weeks. And this was recently achieved. You may have seen it in CNN or other news agencies, the prize being $10 million. There's similarly a prize following Feynman's initial idea, which is now called the Feynman Grand Prize, which has not been claimed. And for those of you who are interested in prizes, you may want to check this out. But what it's offering is $250,000 for the first person to design and build two nanotechnology devices, a nanoscale robotic arm, and a computing device that demonstrates the feasibility of building a nanotechnology computer. And there are very detailed specifications on this webpage as to the real prize, which is out there trying to drive the development of nanotechnology, directly resulting from the notions which Feynman originally introduced. Incidentally, Feynman's prize, his $1,000 prize for the electric motor, was claimed only a few years after he made this speech. Someone was able to make it with very conventional techniques, a motor on a length scale of 1/64 of an inch. His second prize, which was patterning things at 1/25,000th of the scale of current printing technology in 1959, wasn't claimed until 1985 by a graduate student at Stanford University. And they achieved this using electron beam lithography. And we'll talk about that in the early part of this course. The point is that in that particular case, graduate students were the ones who were able to claim the prize. I suspect graduate students will be the ones to claim this prize as well. The first year I taught this course, I had a final exam, and the question was for students to present their solution to this problem. That was a very difficult problem. I don't ask that question anymore. But you may want to think about it because it's relevant, and perhaps the things we're learning in this class will help you achieve this goal. What's interesting is the X Prize you saw was $10 million. This is $250,000. The person who founded X Prize, since that has already been claimed, has now decided to partner with the Feynman Grand Prize and try to raise money to up this to perhaps the multi-million dollar level. And we'll see if that economic incentive will actually induce this to occur. This prize has been out for, I think, 7 years, and no one's claimed it yet. Okay. Are there any questions or comments on Feynman's speech anyone would like to make? Okay. Yes? Oh, Drexler was never a professor at Stanford. He was a graduate student at MIT, and then he basically took off and wrote books on his own. And now he's heavily involved in this Foresight Institute, which I've put up on the screen here. So that's his occupation right now. Okay. All right. If there are no further questions, that will conclude the introductory portion of the course, hopefully giving you some perspective as to where all this came from.